Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, episode 70, a podcast for IT professionals. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm John.
In this special episode, in which we have a couple of pre-recorded segments, John and Jerry interview Liane Bashour about her work in helping companies become open source and her book.
And Al goes over how TLS CSRs work with Windows, and we have a little bit of your feedback, and then I'll talk about a talk I found on VPNs with IPsec. This is going to be a slightly unusual show. Normally, obviously, there'd be the three of us. There'd be Al, Jerry, and myself. In this show, all of our schedules got a bit all over the place. I originally said I wasn't going to be able to record tonight. Jerry went off and organised something else. Al then said, can you do it? I said, yes, I can. Jerry didn't spot that message. Al obviously is here as well. But actually, in the recording that we do a bit later on, and you'll be hearing straight after we talk about this, actually, Al was unavailable. We'll explain a bit more about that in a minute. And so that bit is me and Jerry. So this one is absolutely a game of two halves. Half recorded between me and Al, half between me and Jerry. And then just to make things even more complicated, after our interview, I think Al's actually going to have a little monologue that he recorded by himself. So, it's all a bit all over the place. And I'm really sorry about that, everyone. I hope you understand. But we've got content, so you can't beat that, can you? So on with the interview. So we are very, very lucky today to be joined by VM Bashour, who's also known as Vicky. And she is the author of a book called Forge Your Future with Open Source. So I saw her mentioning online that she was looking for people to talk to, and very generously suggested that she might want to come and join us on the Admin Admin podcast. So welcome to the podcast, Vicky.
Well, hi there. It's lovely to be here.
Al is not in this segment, which is very sad. I'm sure we'll explain a little bit more about that when the wonders of editing put this all together. You are here with Jerry and I. So I was wondering if you could start by telling us a little bit about your background and kind of where this book has come from.
My background. Well, I've been in the tech industry for a little over 20 years now. I've been using and contributing to free and open source software and its communities for about 30 years now. So I've been around for quite a while. I used to be a programmer. Used to run software engineering departments at the director and VP level. So I have been kind of doing this for quite a while. But I left my big corporate job, enterprise-grade job, leading a software engineering department, so I could go freelance, helping companies learn how to sustainably use, understand, contribute to, and release free and open source software in a way that not only helps the company, but also helps the open source community. Because there's a lot of companies out there that are trying to do this, and they have the best of intentions. They just don't really understand how to do it properly. So I help them do that. I'm also the vice president of the Open Source Initiative. So that keeps me somewhat occupied. So I do a lot of that. Do a lot of public speaking at free and open source software events. So last year, it was March, because I was in your lovely country of the UK. I was in Manchester, which was quite nice. I wasn't expecting it to be quite as nice. Great art museum. So I was there, and a friend of mine reached out to me, and he said, hey, as you know, I work for Pragmatic Bookshelf now, and Andy Hunt, our publisher, said he would really love to have a book on how to contribute to open source software. And I thought Vicky would be perfect for that. And after I got done telling him he was absolutely insane, I could never write a book, I actually did sign on to do that. It turned out that there isn't a book about this already. There's plenty of articles. There's various, you know, conference talks that you can find on YouTube and various places like that. But there isn't a single book which consolidates everything into one spot. So I figured the way free and open source software is growing and gaining adoption, and how we are getting literally millions of new open repositories every single year, that's not sustainable if we don't do a better job in training people how to contribute. So I figured this book was overdue by at least 10 years, and it was about time it existed, so I did it. And man, writing a book is hard. I don't recommend anyone do it. But if you do it with Pragmatic, because they were so lovely to work with.
I'm looking through sort of a bit of a summary of sort of what's in the book. And it's quite clear that you're almost sort of following a path through the book. And I'm guessing it's probably in the way that you approach working with open source with companies. You know, why would you want to do open source? And then, you know, what can it do for you? How do you get involved in it? How do you find the right projects to work with? You mentioned that you've been involved in sort of software development and the software industry for, you know, 30-ish years. And what sort of things led you from sort of working for a large corporate company into being involved in open source software? Is there like a big story there, or was it just like an accident of fate?
It wasn't necessarily an accident of fate. I mean, it's something I'd been wanting to do for quite a while, but for many years, as a lot of us listening to this probably know, it wasn't really viable. I left university with a great deal of debt. Could not just throw everything away to spend all of my time working with free and open source software. So you find other ways to contribute. You find other ways to support it. So I would support it inside of an organization. I would advocate for it and try to bring it into whatever team I was working with at the time. There just wasn't the possibility for me with what I was doing to move into a space where I could get paid to do this. Now, in this day and age, this is something that is actually possible. And it's great. It's wonderful that we're finally able to do this. But I no longer program. I haven't programmed full time in, gosh, probably going on 12 years now. So my form of contribution it isn't practical for me to do it as in a programming type way, in a design type way. I could do testing, I can do documentation. But what I do know very, very well is business strategy, is people, is management, is community. It's making sure that people can make the best of their time and move in a positive trajectory, a positive direction. So when the opportunity arose for me to use my business and management and administration knowledge to help further free and open source software, I jumped at it. I mean, I could have stayed in my big corporate job. And frankly, I wouldn't mind going back to big corporate work if that opportunity presents itself. As long as I can continue doing something like this, because I have loved free and open source software for so long, to be able to get paid to work on it, the thought of leaving that is just not really appealing. I could go back to leading software engineering departments, but if I can't continue working in free and open source software, it's just my heart wouldn't be in it quite as much.
Is there a gap in the market for basically a consultant, like an open source consultant, that you know, you can sell your services to a company to show them how to open source?
There'd better be, since that's what I get paid to do for a living.
I see, right.
Yeah, it's not just showing people how to open source things. Obviously, that's part of it. But there's also the compliance. How do you use open source responsibly? You can't just willy-nilly use these things because there are licenses. You have to adhere to the licenses. If you contribute back, how do you do that in a responsible way? And you should contribute back, because that's what helps to become that sort of rising tide that floats all boats. But how do you do that in a way that makes sense for the company? It can't just release software and for no reason whatsoever. They have to be able to get something out of it from a business perspective. And often what I find, the number one question I have every time I go into a company is why? Why are you doing this? And only once have I ever had a company have an answer for that. And they are an amazing company. They're based out of Germany. They really have their head screwed on right. But every other company is pretty much doing it because everyone else is doing it. And I respect that they want to do that, and that's amazing, and I want to help them do that and be successful. But what you see time and time again are organizations that try to participate in open source software. And if they don't know why, and if they don't know what they want to get out of it, then any investment they have, any budget they have for that effort, if it can't show a return on that investment, it becomes the lowest hanging fruit when budget cuts come along. They can't see it. Why they're doing it, so of course we're going to stop.
But where is the sort of impetus for that coming from in the first place? They've got a budget there for open source. Is it their programmers pushing for it, or is it, you know, they've heard it's a good thing to do and that's why they've got a budget for it?
It really depends. Every single company is different. Sometimes it's just because they keep reading in various, you know, tech rags about how open source is the light in the way. And they're like, oh, well, we're going to hop on that bandwagon as well. If everyone else is doing open source, so are we, by gum. But that's not really a strategic reason to do it, right? Other times it is their developers wanting to contribute back and having a very difficult time in that. And so they need to come up with a more streamlined process for that, or a process which says, no, you can't, and here's why. I mean, every single company will have different strategic reasons for doing so and different risk profiles for doing so. And one of the things I find a lot in a lot of the literature that's coming out lately is kind of a one-size-fits-all sort of attitude. Hey, company, you want to participate in open source, just do this, bam, and you hand them a list of things. Just, you know, tick the boxes and you're done. But that doesn't work for every single company. And then what they do is they try and they tick the boxes and then they fail at their effort. And once they fail at their effort, they're unlikely to go back to free and open source software in a reasonable way. You know, they're not going to contribute back. They're not going to release their own stuff because as far as they're concerned, we tried it once, it didn't work. So I try to help companies do that in a way which makes sense for them and make sense for the community, right? They have to get something out of it, be that better marketing, better branding, maybe cut your competitors off at the pass by releasing something that you think they might release in the future, release it as open source now, undercuts your competitor, makes it a lot easier potentially to recruit new developers, which is definitely something that a lot of companies need to consider now because we don't have enough DevOps, we don't have enough sysadmins, we don't have enough developers for the need that's coming up. So any leg up you can get there, that can help, that can be a strategic advantage. But it really depends upon the company and what they're looking to do. So a one-size-fits-all sort of solution, it never works.
So I would have thought, we know, obviously know better, but companies might be against the idea of open source just on the basis of, oh, you know, our code's going to be out there in the open. Anyone can copy it. So obviously there needs to be education. Obviously that has happened now. And the next step is how do they actually do it?
Well, and that is one of the questions as well. If you're going to open source something, what are you going to do? What are you going to release? It does not make sense to... necessarily it can, but that's a different sort of larger strategic question. But it does not necessarily make sense to release the thing that you are making all of your money off of, right? It can make sense for some companies to go open core. That is something that can work, but you have to have a much larger strategic and business plan conversation around that. You don't just release something and say, okay, if we build it, if we release it, the customers will come, because that's not the way this works. So yes, I want people to release software, but I want them to do it intelligently, not just throw things over the wall and assume that it's going to get them some sort of benefit. And they don't know what that benefit is, but it'll get some benefit. So that's yay, that's okay. So I need companies to do this intelligently, and that's what I help them to do.
So as I mentioned, possibly in the pre-show, the three of us that run the podcast, we all have relatively similar backgrounds. As I said, you know, I work for a solutions integrator. Jerry's a freelance working on site with companies that are trying to sort of transform the way they work. Al likewise works for a solutions integrator. If we wanted to try and help a company start down the path of participating, so one of the common use cases that I see in the solutions integrator is they'll take an open source project and they will then use that. They'll consume it without ever considering about plowing back into the community, without considering about feeding that work back upstream. How would you start with from the lower level, start encouraging that kind of shift back to away from just consuming to being a participant?
If the consumption involves changes to the project, if that's necessary in order to do your system integration, then you have to look at the risk profile of the company as far as what, consider their point of view, right? Why would they say no? What are they afraid of releasing things back into the world? So if you understand that, if you can understand why they might not release things back up and contribute things upstream, then you can start addressing those fears. And how you address them depends entirely upon the fear itself, the company, how they interact, what are the buttons you need to push in order to affect the change that you want. But you can't do that immediately. You can't just, you know, start pushing buttons. You have to take the time to understand the entire ecosystem and the environment that you're working in. If you just dig in your heels and you like stamp your little princess foot, no, I'm going to contribute this upstream because it's the right thing to do. Okay, yeah, that might be the right thing to do, but while you are influencing people with that stance, you are not winning friends by doing so, right? And so if your end goal is to get people to contribute, get the company to contribute, then you have to figure out their perspective and then take that and speak their language. It might help to come up with a draft plan. Here's what it looks like for us to contribute upstream, and here's how we track compliance, and here's how we do this and that. And if we have a CLA, right, consider that entire picture. And it doesn't have to be some massive, like, 20-page report, but at least having thought things through and being able to address their concerns before they come to you with them. That shows them that you are keeping their perspective in mind and that you have the best of the company in mind rather than just the best of yourself or for the project.
Are companies looking for a return on their investment? So for instance, if they put aside, say, 10,000 for the year for open source, you know, in the open source pot, as it were, are they looking for a clear return on that?
There's a difference between are they and should they? And what I find is that often they are not because they don't realize they should. And this is not just in open source. You see it with a lot of companies in a lot of the initiatives that they undertake. They don't really have a good idea of what they want to get out of it. And that's just an overall strategic thing that a lot of companies need to get better at. So this is not unique to open source.
It's just I would assume that they would, you know, if they're spending money on it, then there would need to be a business case for it. And, you know, if someone went to their boss and said, you know, we should use open source in this particular way, the boss is going to say, what's in it for us? Because that's, you know, that's how business works. Would you educate them at that level, maybe? Or
yes, I often do that. Or educate is not necessarily the right. I mean, there's obviously some. There's education involved there, but it's more leading them. I'm not there to make decisions for them. I'm there to help them make the right decisions for themselves. And that often takes a more Socratic form where I am asking questions. Oh, you want to do that? Why? Okay, how? Okay, when? Okay, how will you determine that you're being successful? What does failure look like? What does success look like? Because they're not necessarily the opposite sides of the same coin. And in this way, we can come up with an overall plan to get them where they want to go through open source, through free software, through openness. But they have to know where they want to go. Otherwise, they'll never know whether they're on the right path or not.
So you said about sort of knowing what success and what failure looks like. One of the things we sometimes talk about is, you know, looking at a, what's the best case and worst case in something. So what's the best solution? What's the best sort of situation you've gone into? Where's success kind of really shown itself there?
It's not done yet, actually. And that is with a client that I'm working with right now. They really have a very good idea of what they would like free and open source software and openness in general, what they would like to get out of that. And they're being very reasonable and very realistic about the goals, the implementation, and most importantly, I think the time frame. A lot of these organizations are in a big rush to show some sort of progress immediately. Whereas a lot of this stuff, because it is free and open source software, it involves a lot of people and it involves a lot of community. And that takes time, because to make a good impression on a community, you have to build trust. And trust is not built overnight. So that's something that this particular company really understands and is willing to invest the time, the people, the energy to do right rather than doing right now. So I'm really optimistic about where they're going to go. I wish I could give names and companies and stuff.
Yeah, no, I understand that.
On that note, I mean, I'm not going to ask you for specifics, obviously, but there's companies, the couple that spring to mind are HashiCorp and GitLab, just off the top of my head. Now, their products are open source products, and they've also got some software as a service offerings. Are you dealing with those kind of organizations, or is it more the companies that have, you know, that these sort of theoretical companies that have this budget for open source and are wondering what to do with it? Obviously, no names required, but is that the sort of level of clients you're dealing with?
It depends, is the thing. I've worked with companies in all sorts of industries. This isn't just a startup sort of situation. So pick an industry. If you've got like telecom and biotech and manufacturing and education and nonprofits, I'm about to start work with a nonprofit that is releasing some software that it has developed, and it wants to do that in a way that will make a sustainable community for that particular project, because they themselves require that in order for they are going to be using this project, but they need to make sure that it will continue living beyond just them, right? They need the support of other nonprofits, other organizations. So it's really all over the board. It's not just like your standard open core sort of big name company that you've all heard of. The world is a much larger place than just your standard sort of software technology startup world. I mean, everybody uses software now.
I mean, I was just thinking that these companies, they have built a business around producing an open source product, which users are continually helping improve. They're dealing directly with open source, as it were. It's kind of their bread and butter.
There are a lot of companies that do that now, and some of them are somewhat successful and others less so. It really, a lot, again, goes, it's not about the open source. The success of a company is not about the open source. It's not whether they are open core, like, say, HashiCorp or GitLab, or, say, what's the lovely Hadoop company that is escaping me right now? Right. But there's a lot of companies out there that's MongoDB, open core. You know, there's a lot of companies that are open core, but they're not successful because of that. That is just one of the many tools they have in their toolbox to be a successful company. You have to know how to run a company. You have to know how to do your pricing, how to do your outreach, how to do your branding, how to do, you know, all of these other things that are involved in business administration. That is what you have to get right. The open source is only one of the many options that you could potentially use as a company. But those are, you know, again, open core companies. With the predominance of free and open source software in all of technology now, it is the default. And for instance, AT&T has publicly stated that they are only going to use open source solutions now, because it makes sense for them and their business perspective. They are very, very pro open source. So, but they're not an open source company. Right? And that's a lot of companies now are using open source software. And some of them are starting to figure out that they can do more than just consume. They can also give back. They can also release. And so it's really evolving, and it's rather like free and open source software is finally blossoming in a way that we have been trying to get it to for years. I mean, the term open source was coined 20 years ago. The Open Source Initiative was formed 20 years ago. And part of that was to try to make the fundamental tenets of free software more approachable by businesses. And now 20 years later, we finally are succeeding, and we're seeing the adoption, and we're seeing the companies embrace this for very strategic reasons. And finally, they have reached the point where they are feeling comfortable not just using but releasing. And that's what's going to help spread the ethos of free and open source software beyond just the true believers.
So we've talked about deployments where things have gone really well, and we've kind of worked well with companies. What's an example of where you kind of got involved with a company, and you know, for all parties, it's gone the worst it could possibly have gone.
Obviously, I can't.
No, again, not looking for names, but yeah.
There was the biggest failure I have seen so far had nothing to do, again, with the open source, and everything to do with the management, and specifically the lack of it. It was an entirely remote software development team, and by remote, I mean other side of the world, not the other side of the town. So entirely remote software development team that had never had any sort of strategic direction or any management whatsoever. So when the home office was trying to implement an open source initiative, the other side of the world, the development team they didn't have any adult supervision, and so things did not go well.
So presumably not only did they not understand why the home office were trying to kind of encourage this path, they couldn't see kind of how that made any sense based on what their day-to-day job looked like, and presumably what the sort of the end goal for their careers looked like even.
It didn't even get to that point. They were starting, I believe, they appeared to be, or at least they said they understood the reasons for the initiative. And I take them at their word for that. I do believe that they understood that. But it was the mechanics of doing it. What they did not understand were the expectations of a community and a software release once it has gone open, once you have to involve other contributors, external users, right? They were looking to keep a lot of stuff internal, which would have violated the trust of the community, for instance. And to them, this was a technical decision rather than a community decision. Which is not the way you have to operate. Once you open something, it is open, and it is no longer entirely yours. You might direct it in some way and have a hand in directing the project you have released, but it belongs to the community, and you should respect that. And this was not something that the team was able to really grasp very well, and it kept coming back to apparently technical issues with the way things were built and implemented on the back end, and an inability to see how that could change, or even that it should change. And some of that could land with myself. It could be I did a poor job of communicating this, but both I and the other people at the home office tried multiple ways of approaching them to talk about this, and you know, it didn't work, and finally we just parted ways. It was not going to work the way it was. They needed some sort of leadership. They needed technical leadership. They needed management to help keep things in line back at the home at the remote team. I mean, this was only one of the issues with the remote team. They would like blow deadlines by several months and think this was perfectly fine. I mean, there was just a lot of stuff that needed professionalizing. I guess.
That's obviously a bad case. So let's try and turn things around to being happy again. If there's somebody that wanted to start encouraging their firm to start looking at open source, you said before about going out and sort of looking at a business case as to, you know, what benefit does being open be to their company, their community, their project? What sort of things, if you are a manager of a team and one of your team members comes to you having done, you know, some of this research, they've tried some of this themselves, and they're looking to you as a manager, you know, looking to you from a management perspective as going forward, is there anything that the management could do to encourage that kind of conversation to get going? You know, is there anything that they could do to help an employee that's trying to push this from the bottom up?
As a manager, if you buy into the idea, and I assume you mean, do you mean contributing or do you mean releasing? Because those are two different sort of use cases from a business perspective. If you are an individual contributor and you want to contribute to an external project, right, that is a separate issue than, hi, we have this thing in-house that I want to release as open source. So those are two different approaches that you have to take depending upon which one you're looking at. So which are you discussing? Which do you mean?
So again, I'm looking more from the sort of perspective as a company that is currently consuming an open source project and sees where they could be making improvements that benefits both their customer and the community as a whole. So they've gone to their manager and said, I would like to take these improvements and make them work upstream. And we'll then talk about, you know, I've written this piece of software and I want to make it open source afterwards, because you're right, that is a completely separate sort of situation. So let's start with what I think is probably the easier one, but probably isn't.
Nothing's easy.
No.
Yeah, it's always complicated. But if you're a manager who buys into this and wants to make it easier for your team members to contribute upstream in some way, then one thing you can do is make sure that they are given the time and the space to do so, because that is something that is important. You can't expect them to do this on their free time if they are going to be doing it for something that benefits the company. So if I am making a change to a project and it benefits the product that I work on at work, I have to have the space to do that at the office. But also setting up guardrails in advance. Like, is there a CLA required or a contributor license agreement that has to be signed to contribute to this project? Okay, I as a manager, I should go speaking to legal to see what are the policies about this. I should proactively figure out that sort of stuff. Does the company have some sort of risk profile that says that we are not allowed to contribute to something that is under a reciprocal license or a copyleft license? Well, I need to know that in advance and make sure my team knows that in advance. So knowing how to contribute, but also a lot of employment agreements now, most of them will have some sort of intellectual property statement in there. You as blah blah person, as you go to work for this company, all of the work that you do on company time and or on company equipment, even if it is not on company time, belongs to the company. That is in a lot of employment agreements. So I as a manager, I need to look at that so I can in writing get some sort of exception for contributions or potentially change the employment agreement going forward such that it does become easier for my people to contribute. Both GitLab and GitHub have recently, gosh, was it this year or 2017? They announced changes to their corporate employment agreements to make it easier for people to contribute to free and open source software. So that's something as management that you can work toward to make it easier for people to contribute. One of many things. I mean, it is complicated.
Sure. Okay, so we've talked about the contributing. If you are working in a team that is currently closed source or proprietary piece of software, and you are looking to make that an open source or a free software project, if you are currently developing an open source, or sorry, you're currently developing a proprietary piece of software, and one of your employees comes to you and says, you know, I really want to take this as an open source project. I've done some due diligence and I see that there's a niche in the market. This is not part of our core business, or it is part of our core business, but we could change our impact on the community. We could change our trustworthiness. You know, it could drive revenue in other areas. How would you start to help somebody in a management role drive that conversation from that's a good idea to let's do this?
There obviously has to be some sort of a business case for it, right? You can't just release that. And I would first ask my developer or whomever it is coming to me for that to be working on that business case for me, because I won't be as familiar with the project as they are. So I need their help to help develop that. If it is something that the company has, if a company has never released a project before, then the very first thing you do once you have a draft business case is you get people together, and one of those people must be corporate counsel. Don't leave lawyers until the very end. This is very important. Intellectual property has a lot of business value, so don't go shutting the door on your lawyers. That's not going to help anyone. Other people you should get in are your support people. If it's something that has a potential support impact, which some of these will, you should get your security people in the room, absolutely, because there could be some security implications, right? So you have to get everyone in the room to discuss this, and don't go shutting people out. This is not merely a technical decision. This is a business decision to release a project. I also would recommend, if you've never done this before, start very small, right? If you are developing, say, a utility library to aggregate logs in a certain special way that no one else has done that, right? That's not something that has business value unless you're, say, Splunk or one of those who are in the business of aggregating logs. But for just a standard company, that's not something that has business value to you, but it can help others, right? And it is probably a fairly small utility. It's a lot easier to look at, a lot easier to release. It's usually a lot more standalone, does not rely upon your infrastructure. And it's a lot easier to scan at first, because you don't want to, your code is never going to be perfect. Your code is always going to be ugly. Don't let the cosmetic value of your code prevent you from releasing a utility, because that's just stupid. It's just arrogant, assuming that you're going to make it perfect before you release it. But you do have to have a look at it and make sure that if it uses other libraries, if it uses other utilities, you have looked at those licenses and make sure you're in compliance with them, because some of those licenses may influence the license you have to select for the tool that you are going to release. There's so many little steps and pieces of due diligence that you have to consider. I have a talk that I did at OzCon this year in July, and it is about all of these. If you're going to release an internal project, what sort of things you should consider? And it's not a checkbox. It's just a list of stuff that clients and people I've worked with have overlooked, or they're common questions that we have to address. And there's not going to be a single answer for any of them, but it is something that we need to consider. So I did that at OzCon. The video is available, I believe. I need to double check. Yes, because I recorded that one myself. The video is available on Internet Archive, so we can get that in the show notes later. If you remind me, I can get you a link. And I'm also doing it at the same talk, updated, at All Things Open in, about 3 weeks. Holy crap, that's 3 weeks. So if you want to see it live and then ask me questions specifically, then you can come to Raleigh, North Carolina, to All Things Open, which is an amazing conference that I recommend everyone go to anyway. This is, by the way, this is not what the book is about.
No. I was just about to bring it right back to the book, actually. Okay. So,
yeah, I was going to say it looks more like a guide to for an individual from looking at the contents anyway.
Yeah, it's for companies. Carl Fogel has a good book about releasing open source software. So that's more from a company perspective. That's available on... I believe it's available for free on his website, but you can also buy it from O'Reilly Media. And then this is definitely for an individual, but it's not just for programmers. One of the things I think that we in free and open source software have really done a disservice to ourselves with is we have really focused on developers rather than all of the other pieces we need in order to make all the other roles necessary for a successful software project. So this book, while it does obviously speak to developers and it's very applicable for developers, it's also applicable for security folks and sysadmins and documentarians and designers and, you know, even people who simply want to help maintain the community. It's not for programmers. It's for all of the roles that make successful free and open source software projects.
So yeah, so looking through the book, it mentions about what free and open source software can do for you and how you can contribute, the sorts of projects you can get involved in. So, is the book the sort of book that you can kind of pick and choose chapters to read from, or is it very much a start from the front and work your way through kind of book, or how would you approach the book?
I would probably read through it all the way end to end once. While some chapters are standalone, it really works better to read it all the way through and then go back as reference points. Because in order to be successful, just like any software development, free and open source software is, you need a 360 degree view of what's going on, right? If you're only down in the weeds on this one tiny little piece, then you're going to lose perspective and you're not going to be quite as successful. And so I think that reading the entire book does give you that 360 degree view of not only where you fit into the role, where you fit into free and open source software, but what it can do for you. And without both of those sides, I think that you're going to end up very frustrated and annoyed, and or being frustrating and annoying, which is not going to make you successful either.
The book, as I said at the beginning, is called Forge Your Future with Open Source. If you want to know more about the book, where can you find information about that?
So you can either go directly to the Pragmatic Bookshelf website, I believe it's pragprog.com. Frankly, I don't even type it anymore. It just sort of auto-completes in my browser at this point. But an easier way to get to it is fossforge.com, fossforge.com, and that'll take you directly there. It's also on Amazon. I believe that means it's also on Amazon UK, if you're listening in the UK. It is available now, so you can get an EPUB or, I guess, whatever it is, a Mobi, for Kindles. You can get that on the Pragmatic website, so you can get an ebook version now. It's completely done. It is going to the printer today. Holy crap. So that means it is going to be in hard copy in 2 weeks. Again, it will be at All Things Open. Apparently my publisher is going to have me do signings. I've never done one before. I'm pretending this is not freaking me out a little bit. But yeah, it's going to be really weird having a book, but you can get it now. And if you do buy it from the Pragmatic website, then it is DRM free.
Excellent.
You don't have to worry about that.
Apparently the paperback is available from Amazon UK on the 31st of October.
Oh, because it's in the States, I believe it's not until November or something. My editor told me about this the other day. An embargo where the paper version is only available for 2 or 3 weeks through the Pragmatic website. But I think you should buy it from Pragmatic mostly because they're lovely people. And
Amazon may not be so lovely, allegedly.
I
can neither confirm nor deny.
I will make no statement, as I use Amazon a great deal. So when you live in an urban area, and the transit is not great and you don't have a car, then Amazon is your best friend.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I could just yammer on about the book forever, but then I've been working on it for a year, so it's kind of in the forefront of my mind. Writing a book is hard. Man, it's... I'm grateful that it will be done soon.
When's your next book out?
My editor tells me I'm not allowed to think about that yet. He's a great guy. I love my editor. He was a friend before he was my editor, but he's also very good at what he does. So
he's still your friend now he's edited your book.
He is, yes. We had very few arguments, but there were tense moments from time to time. But that's what happens, right? When you're working on a project, you don't always agree, and that's okay. It's okay to disagree, as long as you get through it. And we did. He's great. And he's been doing this for about 20 years, so he definitely knows what he's doing.
So if people want to find more about you, Vicky, where can they go and find out more?
They can go to my website, which is vmbrasseur.com. So it's just my initials, my last name.com. Vmbrasseur. If you find a vmbrasseur online, it's me. And if it's not me, I want to know because I have to go kind of smack someone. So yeah, Twitter, good place to find me if you don't mind a lot of tweets. But definitely my website. And you can find all of my articles listed there, my book, link to my blog, link to all of the conference talks I do. I record my own talks so I can make sure I can always have a recording of them. I upload them all to Internet Archive, which is where everybody should upload their talks and their slides.
And having heard this this conversation, if somebody is... they've heard the way you've talked about open source software, and they think that actually they want to engage you professionally as a consultant to help them open source their software. Would they approach you through the same mechanisms?
Yeah, not through Twitter, if possible. I need somebody to write me, because I haven't programmed in so long. I'm rubbish at it now. I need someone to write me a Twitter DM autoresponder. So when somebody DMs me, it will autorespond with, gosh, that's swell. Could you please send me email instead? Because it's just become yet another inbox that I have to keep my eye on, and that's exhausting. But yes, they can go to my website. There's a contact page with contact information. There's also a services page that gives you more information about some of the things that I can do for you.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for coming on the Admin Admin podcast. It's been a real pleasure speaking to you through this. I wish your book the best success that it rightly deserves from the looks of things. I hope that all your future speaking engagements go swimmingly.
Excellent. I love speaking with both of you. I can't wait to do it again.
So, yeah, that sounds a really good interview, John.
Yeah, it went really, really well. And Vicky was a really good interviewee. So thank you very much, Vicky, for her time talking to us.
Yeah, I was really ashamed I couldn't make it. I double booked myself with meant to be camping with the scouts. I had to be called in at the last minute with my leader warrant to come and look after that. So, but what I really enjoyed about it is that I hadn't really kind of thought about it in that kind of way, because they... The way she was talking about in the interview is about her actual job more than the actual book, I thought, regarding about how she goes into companies and tries and get them to use, if they're writing a product, to get it open sourced. Whereas the book, I thought, would have been more about the if you wanted, like, if I wanted to contribute to open source, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so you're right. Typically, I would have expected her to be talking more about her book and kind of how it came together and things like that. But actually, as it turned out, she's got quite an extensive history working in open source, in open source development. So it was quite a good conversation about how that, if you are working in an open source world, kind of how that work. Well, it wasn't even about that. It was more kind of how you'd introduce the idea of working in an open source way into a corporate environment.
Yeah, definitely. Because that's where I hadn't thought about that. Like, if you're a company and you wanted to give back to the open source. But as Jerry was rightly saying, and it is like, how do you get people, how do you assign the budget to get that money to go to get it back into the project kind of thing? So that's quite interesting. I never thought about it that way, and it's definitely, I can't see many user cases of doing that, but I'm guessing that's how the people like Red Hat and stuff do that, how they work kind of thing. I mean, I don't, Red Hat's based on open source, but I don't know how you'd have a party or a company. You'd have to be some sort of software company, I'm guessing, or some sort of, I don't know, a company which required a bit of software which wasn't out there, and you wanted to give it back to the world, I'm guessing.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of instances of stuff like that. If you look at companies like Netflix, or if you look at organisations like AWS, you know, they've built their whole infrastructure. Etsy is another good example of it. They've built their whole infrastructure around how to roll a software product out that is not something it's not part of their core business. So like a good example of that would be, you know, if you were so talking of Netflix have got a whole suite of tools that simulate failures. So whilst they are useful to their core business is not about simulating failures. It's about delivering content. So they've written this tool. It helps them be more efficient as a company. It helps them be more efficient in the way that they deliver their content. But actually, when it comes to it, it's something that they can release and give away to people. And it's that sort of thing is the sort of thing that I think she's more thinking about. You know, it's so, for example, if you were working, so obviously you and I both work for sort of solutions integrators style businesses. You know, none of what we create in our line of business really is stuff that you need for the company's bottom line. It might make your job easier. It might make your delivery of your job easier, but it isn't actually what makes your company money. So to a certain extent, if you can take that delivery concept back to your management structure, whoever, and say to them, you know, is there any chance we can give this away to people? That's the sort of context that it sounds like Vicky's working in a regular basis.
Yeah, and I think if you're working for a company which is doing a product and it's people are open source, from an open source background, I'm guessing people want to give stuff back to the different projects, or even start a brand new project up. So the one thing she'd also mentioned I didn't know about before was about the Freenode Live. I hadn't heard of that before. Is that something to do with Freenode as in the IRC channel? Or
yeah, the IRC service. So Freenode Live is a conference put on by the people that run the Freenode network. It's in Bristol. It's a weekend. I've not actually been able to make it to one. I did intend to, but haven't managed to. But it sounds like it's a really good event. It's a scheduled conference, so there's speakers. In fact, I'll need to check this, but I'm pretty sure it's a scheduled conference. So there is a track of who's going to be there. It's just about getting people that wouldn't normally meet up face to face, much like a Og Camp style event, you know, getting people that don't meet up on a regular basis into a room together and being able to talk to one another.
So after the last episode, where I completely mucked up about talking about SSL cert renewals on the Winterbox, I thought I would try and straighten things out. A private key is one half of the public-private key pair used in digital certificates. The private key is created before or during the time in which the certificate signing request is created, the CSR. A CSR is a public key that is generated on a server or device according to the server software instructions. The CSR is required during the SSL certification enrollment process because it validates the specific information about the web server and the organisation. The CSR is submitted to the certificate authority, the CA, which uses it to create a public key to match a private key without compromising the key itself. The CA never has access to the private key. The private key remains on the server and is never shared. The private key is incorporated into the SSL cert and shared with clients, which could be a browser, mobile device or other server. Although the makeup of the SSL certificate consists of a public and private key, the SSL cert itself is sometimes referred to as a public key. The SSL cert is also referred to as end entity certificate since it sits in the bottom of the certificate chain and is not used in the signing issuing of a certificate. Do not confuse the server private key with the session key. This is a symmetric key which is created by the browser, which is when it connects to the server. Session keys are typically 128 or 256 bits long. The size depends on the encryption capability of the client and the server. The symmetric key is used to encrypt and decrypt information sent back and forth during the SSL session. The 248-bit SSL certificate and private key is called asymmetrical key pair. This means that one key is used to encrypt the data, the public key, the SSL cert, and the other is used to decrypt the data, the private key stored on the server. So you bought an SSL cert from the likes of GoDaddy so that you don't get a certificate warning when you visit the website you are hosting in IIS. To do this, you need to create a certificate signing request to send to a public CA to get your SSL certificate. When you first generate a CSR, you create a public key which is stored in your local certificate store on the server. This is hidden in Windows until the process is complete, not like in Linux where you can actually see the actual private key as a file. The CSR includes the common names of the domains you want the certificate to protect and other information including the organisation name and organisation location who's asking for the certificate. The CSR also includes the public key which you want to be signed. When you send your CSR to the CA, in my case GoDaddy, they will check who you are. Like, we're not talking about EV certificates, but they will normally ask you to put a file on the website or make a DNS change to confirm that you actually own the domain you're trying to generate the SSL certificate for. They will then sign your public key with their certificates, and they will add things into the certificate like how long it's valid for. To complete the signing request, you copy the public key they provide you to your Windows server. You can then complete the signing request, and Windows will match the public key to the private key stored in the server. If you go into the cert manager in the Windows, you can see the cert has a little key on the cert to show you that you have the corresponding private key to the certificate. Using this key, IIS can then serve this key pair so that when the client connects to the server, the public key is presented. And because it's signed by GoDaddy, and you normally have that GoDaddy root certificate in your certificate store, it sees that it's been signed by GoDaddy and will trust the certificate, and then secure communication can begin. So when it comes to renewal of the cert, GoDaddy already has a copy of your public key via the CSR you supplied them with in the first time. They then generate a new public key from this with a new expiry date for you and send it back to you. This is okay if you're on Linux and you just modify the config to point to a new public key. The problem with Windows is that you can only seem to have one private key match one public key. When you try and import the new public key into your certificate store, it can't find a private key to assign it to. In IIS, you can actually renew the certificate using the new public key provided by GoDaddy. The problem is that it marks it as non-exportable, which is not good for a lot of things I do, because we import it onto one exchange server and then we export it to the remaining exchange servers to sit on the CAS array. The one way which I was talking about last time is the way I found out is that you can use OpenSSL's tool to actually split the public and a private key out. So first of all, you need to export the current certificate private public key pair out of the certificate store into a PFX file. Then using OpenSSL tools, you can then export the private and the public keys into two separate files. These are actually the files you can actually use to migrate the certificate to Win to a Linux box if you require. Because you have the public and the private key in two separate files, you can then discard the old public key and then using OpenSSL tools to combine the private and the public keys together again to a new PFX file, and then you can import this into your certificate store, and then you will see that the new certificate will have this little key on the icon to prove that, so that you have the public and the private key in the store with a little key so that RIS can now use this certificate. John, you wanted to speak to us about the IPsec VPN you were...
Yeah, so obviously a couple of episodes ago we spoke about VPNs. And actually following that session, one of the mailing lists that I'm subscribed to, there was a conversation going on about WireGuard and how it was better or worse or whatever than other VPN products. And one of the guys that works on the... I can't remember which one of the swans. It's either OpenLibre or FreeSwan. It's one of those three. He works for... I think he works for Red Hat as a developer on those, on that product. But he was at a conference in Canada that was fully recorded, where they were talking about IPsec and Ike. And it was... So the first half of... Well, the first third of the talk is about kind of the internals of how IPsec and Ike works from a kernel level. But then the second third is kind of a slide deck explaining how you would configure an IPsec VPN to come up. There's some really good content in there. It's actually really... It's a lot easier than I thought it was. We're going to have the link to that talk in the show notes. I also had a sort of a slightly longer kind of view on how the talk goes and how it was delivered and things like that, which I've actually got on my blog post. So we're going to have a link to that blog post in the show notes as well. But it's a really good video, and I would strongly encourage anyone to go away and watch that if they can.
It is 2 hours long, just to warn you.
It is, but so I do actually call out some specific times in the blog post that I'm linking to, and that's where content starts to go. And essentially, there's a slide deck, and then at the end of the slide deck, the guy that's giving the talk then moves on to more like a workshop where he's trying to show people how they do. So there's a thing that they're trying to introduce in these IPsec protocols called opportunistic encryption.
Yeah.
And essentially what that gives you in the IPsec world is when you do a DNS record lookup to see what the IP addresses of the host that you're trying to connect to, this opportunistic encryption will also try and request the key for the opportunistic encryption IPsec tunnel, and will then try and establish an OE, opportunistic encryption, IPsec tunnel to that server before it then tries to bring the rest of the tunnel up. And essentially it means that if you wanted to do, say, Telnet or FTP to a host that you would prefer to be going over a VPN tunnel, but you don't want to have to set it up on lots and lots and lots of servers, you can just do this opportunistic encryption to just have it so that when you FTP from a host that does OE, it'll create the OE tunnel. Now, that's what the last sort of third of that video is all about. And actually, in that video, he has a lot of problems making it work because the conference Wi-Fi and DNS caching and all those sorts of fun things go horribly wrong for him, which is part of the reason why it's quite a long video. But it is a really good set of content to use. So definitely worth a watch out for.
So we had some feedback. Well, listeners have emailed in since our last two shows. So one is from Will, and it says, in one episode, it was asked what listeners to do for their backups. Like one of the hosts, I use Restick to backup to B2. It works pretty well. My main complaint is that B2 does not have a rich access management system like AWS. As far as I can tell, the API keys I need to use to backup to my bucket has to give full access to the bucket. In my ideal world, I could use one key with read-write permissions, but not file versioning permissions. So even if my machine was compromised and someone used the key to delete my bucket, I could still recover the files from the file version history. The developer of the Restick does an interview on the Go podcast, and I was impressed with how thoughtful he had been about the design. I only backed my machine up to one bucket, but I saw some discussions that the locking mechanism for backing up multiple machines to one bucket might not be so robust. I'm a hobbyist sysadmin, and I was interested in setting up a Nextcloud server on my home network. What do you think about setting up a VPN only for traffic to the Nextcloud server so I can access it from my laptop or phone outside of the house? Is this a good way of accessing it, or should I try and put the server on the internet and keep it properly secured?
Well, I'm not sure about you, but I think so realistically, this stuff always comes down to what's the threat that you're trying to protect against. For most people, I would say that as long as the web host you're running is relatively secure, so, you know, for example, you've got strong credentials, you don't expose any unnecessary ports. So, for example, you wouldn't have an SSH port open to the internet unless you need it. You wouldn't have the web ports open to the internet unless you need it. So in this case, you would need a Nextcloud. If you wanted to have a Nextcloud server on your home network, absolutely leave it on there, have it set up. If you've got enough hardware to be able to set up what some people refer to as a three-tier network, a Y-shaped router combination, where you've got like a DMZ router that can't see into your home network, so you can only connect out to it, things like that, that might help. I would definitely say that having a VPN only for traffic to a Nextcloud server is probably overly complicating things. If it was the only thing you were trying to protect, then I would say don't do it. If you wanted to set up something like a proxy from home so that all your traffic is routed via that, or if you wanted to, when you're out and about, route through your home network, then yeah, absolutely use a VPN for that. But if it's purely just to protect the traffic to your Nextcloud server, I would say no. Just set it up as an HTTPS server. Maybe change the port that it's on, but I wouldn't do anything more complicated than that, really. How about you?
I'm always a bit curious. I definitely have it in the DMZ. I don't know if having it directly connected to our network. If someone hacks it, then they're on your internal network then. And I think unless it's your full-time job of like looking after it, then that's what I would do. Definitely have it on like a DMZ so that if they hack it, then it's you can only do it. But it depends what sort of information you've got on that Nextcloud server, really, isn't it? If don't put anything like your bank details or anything on there. I'd always kind of just, if it's got personal information or something which you can use to steal your identity, I'd definitely have it kind of behind some VPN kind of firewall or something. That's what I would. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. So to be fair, I mean, again, it pretty much comes down. You're exactly right. If it's your day job is looking after servers, then yeah, absolutely. Have a host, have it sit in there, treat it as though it's the same sort of server that you've got elsewhere in your day job. If you don't treat it in the same way that you would treat a server out in your customer's estate or your corporate network, then yeah, it's a dangerous thing to have. And you should absolutely sort of enforce access controls to it then.
It's just keep it on top of it, because if there's like a, that's what I say, if there's nothing really matter on there you don't mind getting, because like if you have like a breach or something, like someone comes up with a new vulnerability and you haven't and you're not patching your stuff, and then they can then get in or something and get that information.
Mm. I definitely came across, so it's actually triggered a memory for me. There's a Reddit sub a subreddit rather called what's this device or what's this thing. I can't remember exactly what it is. Again, I will find it for the show notes and put it in. But so somebody found attached to the back of their router a Raspberry Pi in a box, and they discovered that their housemate had been paid $15 to attach this box to the back of their network, and they would then get a repeating payment of, I think it was $5 each month. And essentially, it was acting as the router for the network. So it was routing all the traffic through itself before it went out to the internet. So they were capturing all the in the clear credentials and things like that. And you just got to think that any box that's on your network, okay, this was a explicitly malicious box put on your network, but any box that's on your network could be used for the same purpose. You know, if you don't have IPv6 in your network, for example, somebody could set up an IPv6 DHCP server on a box if they can compromise it, and then all your boxes will try and talk IPv6 first because it's the new greatest protocol to be using. So then they'll be routing IPv6 traffic through your IPv6 DHCP gateway and router, and then out over an IPv6 tunnel or an IPsec tunnel to the internet. You don't control that traffic anymore. You are absolutely at the control of whoever it is that exploited your machine. But if you're not looking for things like that, you won't see them. So anyway, I've waffled on quite heavily on that one, so sorry about that. So we also got an email from Mark, who said, I remember listening to an episode, maybe it was last year, where one of you had come across a situation where a comms cabinet had been lifted and all that was left was a structured cable, and you were wondering how to identify the cable. I didn't reply because I was listening to an episode which I think at the time was a couple of months old, but in that situation, I would be inclined to bell the cable out using a bell toner or tone signal generator, or sometimes they're known as a wah-wah for the sound they produce, just in case you come across a situation like that in the future, or even in situations where a cable is not correctly identified. This bit of kit is essential. Here's a link to a tone sender I've used myself and couldn't fault, and he links to a product which will stick in the show notes. I have to be completely honest, I have got two of those myself, and they are absolutely fantastic and the bee's knees.
Yeah, I've seen people use them. I've never used one myself. I might have to get one. And Mark is from the Binary Times podcast, which I found about a month ago, and I emailed in because I didn't know anyone emailed in, and he emailed me. That's what he emailed me back with. So, hi there, Mark, the Binary Podcast or the Binary Times Podcast.
I've listened to it as well, and it's a really good podcast. So, so continuing our theme of plugging someone else's podcast, absolutely go and find yourself the Binary Times because it's really good.
Okay, so I think we're just about the end of our show tonight. Before we go, we're going to mention Dave. Thank you again, Dave, for doing our audio.
Yep, as always, Dave does a fantastic job of this, and I think this one, in fact, is going to be even harder than normal because he's splicing together about six different recordings. So thank you very, very much, Dave. You are, as always, a scholar and a gentleman. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening, and we'll speak to you all soon.
Speak to you again soon.